Me.
Hello there. You're about to listen to an interview with Irish writer Emer McBride. The interview took place at the Federal University of Santa Catarina in Florianópolis, Brazil, in November 2022, as part of the sixth edition of our Irish Studies Symposium. I had the pleasure to interview Emer back then. My name is Aline Fernandez. I'm Senior Lecturer in English and Translation at the Federal University of Santa Catarina. Relax and enjoy.
Hello.
Okay, hello everyone. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for being here with us. This afternoon I'll be interviewing Emer McBride. I'll be reading from my notes, if you don't mind. I'm very pleased and honoured to introduce you to Emer McBride today. Emer is the author of very intense and varied writing when it comes to style. She's published three novels, A Girl's Half-Formed Thing, published in 2013, The Lesser Bohemians, 2016, and A Strange Hotel, 2020. She has also published the short stories Ivy Day in the Committee Room in Prospect in 2014. And that was also published in Dubliners 100, right? Through the Wall in The Long Gaze Back in 2015. Atheist in White Winter Papers in 2017. The Essays, If I Rule the World in Prospect 2016, amongst various others for The Guardian and BBC Radio 4. As well as the non-fiction book, Something Out of Place, Women in Disgust, from 2021. She grew up in the west of Ireland and studied acting at Drama Centre London. In 2017, she was awarded the inaugural Creative Fellowship at the Beckett Research Centre at University of Reading, which resulted in the performance works Mouthpieces, later broadcast on RTE Radio and published by Faber & Faber in 2019. She's also a screenwriter and currently has scripts in development with Seesaw Films, House Productions and DMC Film, each commissioned, co-commissioned by BBC Film, and she has contributed with forewords to books by Anna Akhmatova, Edna O'Brien and Elizabeth Hardwick. Last but not least, she is the recipient of the Women's Prize for Fiction, Goldsmiths Prize, Desmond Elliott Prize, James Tate Black Memorial Prize, Jeffrey Faber Memorial Prize, and the Irish Novel of the Year Award. She is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and lives in London. That's a bad part.
All the way through.
Yeah. So today I'm in charge of interviewing this powerhouse woman whose impressive trajectory inspires so many aspiring writers and delights readers. Emer leaves a mark on the reader wherever she goes. Emer is the first invited artist to be with us in person after COVID-19. And for this, I'm truly grateful, and in particular to Emer herself, of course, and the Irish Consulate. Emer, you're here at last.
I am.
Right after our two rounds of elections. The country has been immersed in excitement and turmoil at the same time, things that only Brazil can afford, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for accepting our invitation to be here in the sixth edition of our study symposium, and I hope you're already having a good time.
Yes, I'm having a great time. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you everyone for inviting me. You'd be so welcome. Saying so many nice things about me. It's only just begun.
Okay, well, in line with this year's theme, my questions will revolve around modernisms, the reception of your work, taboo topics, your influences and models, amongst other things. This is meant to be more of a conversation, kind of. One of the several ones I seem to be having with you inside of my head for the past few months since I started planning this interview. So, If I sound or look crazy, this is the reason. Okay, so my first question to you is, 22 is the year of the centenary of the first publication of James Joyce's Ulysses. You've been interviewed by so many important journalists, critics, and scholars about Joyce's influence on your writing. In a conversation with N.N. Wright and Dr. Claire Hutton, organised by the British Library, you even said that Joyce showed you that anything could be done in terms of writing. So Joyce was the beginning of a major shift in your life. Inspired by Joyce, you're known for having brought forth a renaissance of modernism in the 21st century. How does it feel to be responsible for the revival of modernism nearly a century after the publication of perhaps what is its major canon?
Great.
It's a very simple question.
I think for me, it was something that I suppose maybe having not come out of an academic background, didn't realise that modernism was supposed to be dead. And so that was what interested me. And so when I started writing, that was what I went towards. And it was really only when I started trying to get published that I realised that actually modernism was supposedly dead. And no one was interested in that sort of thing anymore. So it took me took me 9 years to get my first book published. And but at the moment that it was published, I think there was a change in the publishing industry and in readers' appetites. I think there had been kind of an increasing sense of frustration and boredom with what the reading public were being offered. I think the industry itself was very much in crisis because of the arrival of the internet and the fear that publishing would be decimated the way the music industry had been decimated. And so there had been a lot of cynicism about churning out very, very safe things, which continues to this day. Mm-hmm. But there was a brief period around 2013, and A Girl is a Humble Thing was part of that, where that suddenly broke open, and a lot of people who were interested in modernism were very pleased to see something influenced by that appearing and kind of jumped on that. And it also then proved that there was lots of people who were writers who were interested in that, who were working away ignored up until that point. So, and the book was helpful in kind of pushing that door open, but the world still existed underneath it all. We'd just been told no one was interested in experimental work anymore, and modernism was dead, but it is here. It's alive among us.
Okay, I think I might. Hello. Hello.
Hi.
Okay, sorry. So I might get back to that point of, the hardships of publishing A Girl is a Half Formed Thing. But before that, following my script here, differently from Joyce, who very explicitly had always had very ambitious intentions behind his work, like Ulysses itself being a demonstration of his readings and profound knowledge of the literature published up to his time, your uses of the stream of consciousness depict what's going on inside the minds of common people. Of course, Joyce is also about the common people, but there's this huge display of encyclopedic knowledge, right, throughout the novel. We have a girl growing up in the countryside, a young woman who moves to London to start drama school, a low-key actor, a woman who travels around the world and who's in search of herself, while at the same trying to escape from some past that she can never leave behind. Your characters are relatable as everyday people in their struggles, traumas, suffering, and earthly desires. Besides your literary influences, how does your own observation of people affect your writing?
I think for me, characters is the beginning and the end of everything for me, and that comes out of where I started, really, which was wanting to act. And so when I was 17, I went to London and I went to Drama Centre, which was a notorious Stanislavski hardcore method acting school, and I spent 3 years there, in which they kind of taught you how to deconstruct what it was to be human and what you needed to look at in order to reconstruct a character. And so when I started to write, that was the tool that I had. That's what I knew how to do and what I was interested in, because I was always interested in character and people and in language, but then in trying to apply a kind of method technique to writing, understanding that in order to do that, language had to be used in a different way, that kind of linear grammatical language was completely inadequate when it came to the kind of intimate reconstruction of what it is to be a person, both the inside, the internal life, but also the intimacy of inhabiting a body in the world and how those two things interact. And so, you know, people and observation is completely central to me. Without that, the language would not exist in the way that it does, and the books would be academic exercises, I think, rather than hopefully kind of living, breathing experiences for the readers.
Do you, as a writer, can you hear me?
You used to point it right at your
face. Yes. As a writer, do you feel that you're also kind of a voyeur, like in the sense that you're, you know, kind of prying into people's lives?
Yes, necessarily, I suppose I am, but I think I don't subject anyone to greater scrutiny than I do myself. I mean, I think, you know, it sort of galls me to admit it, but of course there are a lot in all of my books that the jumping off point comes from somewhere inside my own life. Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, I don't feel as though I'm invading anyone worse than I'm invading myself. And once you're willing to invade yourself, then it's kind of everyone else's fair game, right?
Thank you. Still in relation to your non-literary influences, you've mentioned in one of our email exchanges some works that have been important to the writing of A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, such as Lars von Trier's film Breaking the Waves from 1986. You've also mentioned that Tarkovsky's film Nostalgia from 1987, and the second album by the band Tindersticks from 1985 were very influential to the writing of The Lesser Bohemians. And I can already imagine an awesome film adaptation with Tindersticks playing for its soundtrack. Can you talk us through how those two films played such important roles in your writing, and also the importance of Tindersticks to The Lesser Bohemians?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been a magpie, and it's a very important influence on my writing, is that it doesn't come out of an academic place, and it doesn't really come out of a literary place. Because again of the acting training, I try to be constantly alert to the world and finding ways to translate what I see and what I hear into language. And so there are differences. So music was very, very important to the writing of Lesser Bohemians, and it began really with just trying to, because the novel is set back in the same era that I went to London and went to drama school. And so initially it was just about memory, about recreating that memories of that time and place, of trying to capture the atmosphere of what it was to be in Camden in the early 90s, and the kind of people who were there and all the things that were happening. And so I just started to listen to music that I had listened to back then, listening to Pulp and, you know, Blur and all of that sort of Britpop stuff. And then I discovered a tape that someone had made me back in the day of this Tindersticks album. And I hadn't listened to it for years, but I had listened to it back then a lot. And I put it on, and it immediately transported me back to that time. But also, the more I listened to it, the more it became sort of a talismanic work for the Lesser Bohemians. It seemed to explore so many things that I was interested in, but also because The Lesbian is the first time that I was writing a male character, a really significant male character, who you get to see in kind of 3D. It was quite interesting to listen to this music, which is, you know, it's an all-male band, and the lead singer, Stuart Staples, writes most of the songs. And a lot of those songs are, you know, about struggling and how to be a good man in the world, mm-hmm. how to be a father, how to be a lover, how to deal with the worst sides of oneself. And it just... It sort of taught me to think in a more complex way. And also because music is necessarily more immediate and more emotional, you get to see people in a much more intimate way than you would if they were telling you the same story, but it was written down. And so I think it's an interesting access point for women writing about men, because the male voice is suddenly much more vulnerable in that kind of situation. I mean, obviously none of it's Metallica or something, but, you know, I think Tindersticks is, you know, there's a kind of a sophistication, an approach to the world and awareness. And so, you know, that kind of became a very, very important record to me, and I listened to it millions of times. Bizarrely, many years later, I met Stuart Staples, and he read Les Bohemians, and he was... You know, he just said, wow, it really reminded me of that time. God. So that was very important. But going back before, also, so Tarkovsky's Nostalgia was also a really important film for Les Bohemians, because, again, there was this kind of lost male character who is trying to find a way to return to their own humanity, to themselves. And there's something about Tarkovsky who, you know, he just sets himself outside of time and out of all the constraints of how, of expectation of how story is told and what are the important things to look at. And that, I found that very kind of liberating, to just think, okay, if I want to have a 30-page monologue in the centre of this novel that is completely different to the rest of the novel, what would Tarkovsky do? He'd just do it, right? So, it felt, again, like Joyce, like someone who just kind of, in their production of their own art, gives permission, because they just take a space, and you think, well, if they can take a space, I can take a space, why not? Breaking the Waves, so the Lars von Trier film was... It was a more visceral influence, although of course there are similarities in the narrative to Girls to Have Fun Thing about the young girl and the kind of abuse she goes through and the pursuit of love and disappointment. For me, it was the first time I'd ever left a cinema and felt like someone had just punched me in the stomach. And it's a very hard film to watch, and it's very, you know, quite shocking. And I just remember thinking, I would like one day to make something that makes other people feel like that. So I do like to make people suffer a lot, it seems.
You did it.
I just thought that to be able to create something that powerful, that it's something that's not a talking point, it's something that goes beyond language, where you just kind of go, I don't know what happened, but something enormous has just happened. That was, you know, I kind of felt that von Trier set the bar quite high at that point, and I wanted to see if I could follow.
Thank you. We could say that Tindersticks worked as a memory trigger, really, and nostalgia worked to help you think of structure in terms of... the structure of the novel itself, like having a narrative inside a narrative.
Yeah, I think so. But something that is also dealing with a lot of emotion but isn't busily explaining that to you, that kind of is the thing itself, you know, is the experience as you're watching the experience, as came up in one of the panels earlier today, which I thought, that's exactly what it is to experience the film. And I think with Tarkovsky, who requires so much investment, and concentration. Yeah. And it's quite transformative to go through the experience of watching those films, where you feel like you've invest yourself. And again, this is important for me in terms of style and writing, and knowing that I was asking a lot from readers, that they weren't just getting a traditional narrative. They open the book and everything is clear. They have to invest and they have to work. But actually, hopefully, by the time they get to the end, they feel that that effort and investment has been worthwhile for them. And, you know, and it's seeing those other models where I felt, okay, I've participated in this work. I haven't just experienced it, but I have actively participated in it. It's very, you know, kind of profound experience, I think.
Thank you. It's really interesting. I think you've just spoken about models. The magnificent North American writer, Alice Walker, in an essay titled Saving the Life That Is Your Own, The Importance of Models in the Artist's Life, she wrote about the importance of having fellow artists and writers, not only as sources of inspiration, but as sources of strength, in important references that psychologically and emotionally validate what we do. She says that Vincent van Gogh killed himself as he was suffering under an absolute lack of models. She concludes her essay saying, "It is, in the end, the saving of lives that we writers are about, whether we are minority writers or majority. It is simply in our power to do this. We do it because we care. We care that Van Gogh mutilated his ear. We care that behind a pile of manure on the yard, he destroyed his life. We care because we know this. The life that we save is our own." It's a very powerful citation. I love this passage, and I thought you'd enjoy it too.
Yes.
So I'm not talking about influences now, but not in formal terms, but models in the sense Walker is talking about here, if we can differentiate the two. So who would be your models and why? Do, for instance, Edna O'Brien and Enright, for once, stand as such figures in your life? Or even a non-figures, I don't know.
Yes, I mean, Edna O'Brien's always been hugely important to me. And before I was a writer myself, so really, it was reading Country Girls when I was, you know, 13, under the covers. Away at the Gaeltacht, which is the Irish language summer school, where we should not have been reading Edna O'Brien back in those days. It was, I think, the my first adult experience of literature, where I was old enough to be able to sit outside it somewhat and understand that what she was doing with language was making the whole experience so much more powerful than just telling the story, or even sort of the inclusion of kind of sexual desire, which was incredibly exciting when I was 13. But that the language itself and the way that it filled those spaces was the purpose of it. And so, yeah, before I knew anything about her, before I knew any of the stories of the Country Girls and what happened and all the crap that she's had to put up with over the years and all the kind of bizarre sexism and what she has come to stand for, she was important just for how she could put words on the page. Mm-hmm. And of course now she is important to me for all of those other things as well. The ability to continue in the face of stupidity and sexism and ignorance and the self-congratulation of people who delight nothing more than, you know, trying to explain away the importance of work as sentiment or something. It's just, so she's great. And so, yes, she's always been an important figure for me. Yeah. But I think also someone the musician Scott Walker was I would say is a very important figure to me, because that was someone, you know, who was kind of the great pop star of the 60s and the Walker Brothers, who then turned his back on fame and being sort of gorgeous Californian sex god, and started to create this incredibly anxiety-inducing modernist music, the like of which, you know, still has no parallel in contemporary music. Mm. And just obsessed about creating what he wanted to create. So the idea of the artist who is willing to just do what they want in the face of all logic, which suggests that it is impossible for them to do that and pointless for them to do that, that's the kind of person I find very inspiring. And, you know, good for the soul, purifying for the soul in the face of all the pressures to be this and do that and, you know, write this kind of book or say these kind of things in public. Someone who is utterly engrossed in what they are doing to the detriment of their career is a great inspiration, I think.
Mm. Amazing. And always being bold and brave.
Yeah, and also just to be stubborn, to refuse, to accept that transgression is the mode by which you make your art, your music, write your book, and to accept that transgression will necessarily annoy and insult people, that you will be an aggravation and a thorn in the side, that not everyone will be pleased with you, and people will take great delight in making sure you know that, and to continue, to try to continue with a pure soul anyway, despite it, which is not an easy thing to do, because we all like, you know, money and mortgages and all that stuff that, you know, that goes on in life, but to continue to be transgressive, to refuse the role of acceptance, of being the kind of the great artist who is fulfilling the thing that everyone thinks they should be doing. It's very, very important to just dig your heels in and do your own thing against the wishes of everyone, which is, you know, in a way, how Strange Hotel got written. Like an act of, yeah, everyone thinks I'm this kind of writer, but maybe I want to be this kind of writer. And yeah, I think Scott Walker was an important idea there.
So being coherent and loyal to no one but yourself.
Well, to be loyal to nothing but the thing that's driving you to do what it is you're doing, because that, if you betray that, that's the end. Then there's nothing else. It doesn't matter what you do, it doesn't matter where you get invited to speak or what jobs you get offered. If you break the thing, the only thing that drives you forward, then you're done, right?
Yeah. What's the point? Yeah. Right? Yeah.
It's just the same book over and over and over again.
Yeah. Oh my, this is my very long question, I'm sorry.
That is a long question.
I'm trying to sum it up. Okay, now I'm moving on. It's like a whole page. I'm moving on more specifically to Strange Hotel, my most recent reading of yours. Strange Hotel was indeed a difficult read, as you yourself acknowledge in your interview for the Bay Area Book Festival back in 2020, if I'm not mistaken. From the point of view of someone who's read what you wrote prior to Strange Hotel and in chronological order, like me, it looks easier from the outset, but then you realise you're fooling yourself as a reader. Like, no. What made me groundless at times in the book was the lack of context. As a reader, I kept looking for information about the unnamed protagonist, as so many whys remain practically unanswered in the novel, like until the end of the novel. Like, however, it grew on me, and I appreciated it even more after preparing for a discussion with our students, and especially after discussing it with them. There's so many topics that we could discuss. There's so much in Strange Hotel, but I'd like to talk about suicide. It's a taboo topic. And you're a master of dealing with taboo and transgression and just putting it out there. There's a passage that I would like you to read from that is, it starts on page 46, I think is the last line. That's the
however.
However, yeah. And then going on to the end of the paragraph on page 47, please.
Okay. However, if the truth is, as she's just insisted is the case, that everything still lies where it lay, that the past is immobile and can never be resuscitated, she's at liberty to think about it as much as she likes. She doesn't imagine she will, but were she so inclined, she might admit that the thought of a jump had occurred to her most days, for maybe a year and a half, the thought that she could, or that she even might. Not to mention randomly calculating the height of whatever building caught her eye. No, not to mention that. But actually, now that it's too late not to think about it, every day would be more accurate. And on some days, every hour, some hours, every minute. And really, for 2 years or more.
Thank you. That really reminded me of N. Wright's Night Swim. That was published in 2020 as well, in March 2020 in the New Yorker. There's a passage that says she did not know what she was doing in this place. It was coming to catch her, even here in the present. It was coming to catch her children. The Night Swim was not the end of it, of what she had tried to do back when she was younger. She had been enthralled to death for some time afterward, months, a year. Because, of course, you could leave the lake, but you could not leave desire itself in all its impossibilities. Flirting with the possibility of ending it all, but not actually doing it, the thrill of the flirtation itself. Could you talk about this? Because it's something that it's there in Strange Hotel. It's like from the beginning until... how was it? How is it to write about something that feels so forbidden? And of course, not in a nonchalant way, but in a legitimate and very kind of serious way.
Well, I suppose the start is to think that it is not a forbidden topic. There are no forbidden topics. There are only things that happen in life. And all things that happen are interesting, and all things that happen are worth examining and thinking about. And you know, the idea of this woman who thinks about suicide, thinks about having thought about suicide, more to the point. Again, it comes out of character. And although you are given very few cues as to who this person is, why she is, where she is, what she's doing, what she's supposed to be doing when she's there, what you do come to know, of course, is that she has lost someone that she loved. And that loss of intimacy has, in order to survive it, she has refused herself all forms of intimacy since then, apart from physical intimacy. But that this has also extended into refusing intimacy with herself, to even to thinking about herself, to considering. And so a lot of the book is an attempt by someone not to get to know themselves, but to escape themselves, to not think about the things in their past which caused them pain, or once made them happy, and the loss of which now causes them pain. And so, also, I think when you go through the experience of losing someone close to you, you do become, for a time certainly, more untethered from life yourself, because you have been close to the someone who has gone over the edge, who has gone to the other side, who is no longer there. And so death stops being theoretical, mm-hmm. and becomes a physical presence in your life. And the absence of life allows you to imagine your own not being there anymore. And of course, pain encourages you to think about ending it, ending pain in one way or another. And so it was not out of a desire to write about suicide, but a desire to write about what it is to be a person who has been in pain, mm-hmm. who has wanted to stop being in pain,
yeah.
and who has gone to great lengths to create a life in which she is completely in some kind of stasis, where she doesn't feel anything because she's trying so hard to not feel pain that she's lost her ability to kind of make human connection. And, you know, the point of the book is that she gets to the end and it's like she realizes that, and should she do something or should she not do something about it, and is she willing or not? And so of course the idea of suicide is also present in my first novel, Girl is a Half Home Thing, but again it's something that is a reaction to death of a loved one. And I just think it just pushes people to walk on a strange path for a time. Mm-hmm. Most people come back, some people don't come back.
How does one deal with grief, right?
Yeah. This is the impossible agony of something that, even if you know it's coming, you cannot be prepared for.
Absolutely. Thank you. That was quite deep. We still have 15 minutes. I'm keeping track of time here, unfortunately, but you know, it's what one is supposed to do. Okay, now, you know, changing subjects quite a bit. I would like to know more about the reception of your work in translation. Okay, if you, I don't know, like, how has it travelled outside the English-speaking world? I know of translations of A Girl's a Half-Formed Thing into Spanish and French. Apparently it's been translated into European Portuguese as well, I think.
Yeah,
The Lesser Bohemians into Dutch, for instance. How does the translation process usually go? Do translators get in touch with you, or the other way around? Like, oh, what are you doing with my novel? Do any exchanges take place? How do you feel about having your work translated? And how has been the reception of your work outside the English-speaking world? And these questions are quite important in this context because we have loads of translation students here, so.
Yeah. Well, I've had lots of bitter experiences of translation. But also some wonderful experiences of translation, I have to say. And, you know, I'm very wholeheartedly pursue any kind of translation avenues. I'm very keen for my work to be available in lots of different languages. Although I do understand that the nature of it, of the language itself, is a barrier to translation. So to that end, for instance, the book has been sold into many different languages for translation, and many of those languages have never ever managed to translate it. So there's been lots of enthusiasm to try, but either they couldn't find the right translator for it, or the translator started it and felt that they couldn't do it. That said, I've also had some like really wonderful translation experiences. So the translator I'm closest to is my Croatian translator, who's done both Lesser Bohemians and Strange Hotel. And I have a really kind of extraordinary relationship with her where, you know, I kind of wait, I look forward to her. She sends me these long lists of questions, always in an email that says, I've just got a quick question. And then 20 questions.
Like my question.
Yeah. So many, many caveats to this question. And it's, I mean, one, it's incredibly flattering that someone is willing to put so much work into your work and so much time and effort and thought, and that's, you know, obviously you end up having quite a close bond with them because, and you also realize that the act of translation is a creative act. This is not a technical, I can sit down and I know this word and I'm going to put that word there and then meaning will be clear, and especially not with books like this. It requires someone who not only, you know, has the facility of language, but has the capacity for and making an imaginative leap into inside the work. And I know that Amda in Croatia, that it is an imaginative leap she has to take, because often the literal translation doesn't capture the point of the passage, and so, and she understands that. Mm-hmm. And so often her questions will be more about the wider meaning mm-hmm. of the piece rather than what exactly do you mean in this sentence. I mean, sometimes there are those questions, but more often it's, this is what I think this is about, am I right? Mm-hmm. And then we'll tweak it a little bit. Okay. And, but because, you know, she's very sensitive to the language and very sensitive to the what I'm trying to do in the books, she, more often than not, she is like exactly right first time around,
right,
which is
okay.
very, very interesting. But then I've had other, you know, less great experiences where, for instance, a translator has